Welcome to Damn Good Movie Memories with your host, Brian Davis. This podcast is the cure for your long commute and super boring workday.
Hey there, it's Brian Davis, and for this week's episode, we're going to cover the movie Bonnie and Clyde from 1967. The studio is Warner Brothers. The release date was August 13, 1967, and the running time, 111 minutes. The budget was $2.5 million. The box office took in $50 million. That's the equivalent of $450 million today. It was the fifth-ranked movie of 1967. Roger Ebert at the time, 4 out of 4 stars. Here's his review. Bonnie and Clyde is a milestone in the history of American movies, a work of truth and brilliance. It is also pitilessly cruel, filled with sympathy, nauseating, funny, heartbreaking, and astonishingly beautiful. If it does not seem that those words should be strung together, perhaps that is because movies do not very often reflect the full range of human life. Under Arthur Penn's direction, this is a film aimed squarely and unforgivingly at the time we are living in. It is intended, horrifyingly, as entertainment, and so it will be taken. The kids on dates will go to see this one, just like they went to go see Dirty Dozen and Born Losers and Hell's Angels on Wheels. But this time, maybe, they'll get more than they counted on. The violence in most American movies is of a curiously bloodless quality. People are shot and they die, but they do not suffer. The murders are something to be gotten over with, so that the audience will have its money's worth. The same is true of the sex. Both are like the toy in a Cracker Jack box. Worthless, but you feel cheated if it's not there. In Bonnie and Clyde, however, real people die. Before they die, they suffer horribly. Before they suffer, they laugh and play checkers and make love or try to. These become people we know. And when they die, it is not at all pleasant to be in the audience. When people are shot in Bonnie and Clyde, they are literally blown to bits. Perhaps that seems shocking. But perhaps at this time, it is useful to be reminded that bullets really do tear skin and bone, and that they don't make nice round holes like the Swiss cheese effect in Fearless Fosdick. We're living in a period where newscasts refer casually to waves of mass murders. Richard Speck's photograph is sold on posters in Old Town, and snipers in Newark pose for Life magazine. Perhaps they are busy now getting their ballads to rhyme. Violence takes on an unreal quality. The Barrow Gang reads its press clippings aloud for fun. When C.W. Moss takes the wounded Bonnie and Clyde to his father's home, the old man snorts, "What did they ever do for you, boy? Didn't even get your name in the paper." Is that a funny line or a tragic one? The performance throughout are flawless. Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway in the title roles surpass anything they have done on screen before and establish themselves, somewhat to my surprise, as major actors. Michael J. Pollard, who plays C.W. Moss, the driver and mechanic for the gang, achieves a mixture of moronic good humor and genuine pathos that is unforgettable. When Bonnie tells him, "We rob banks," and asks him to come along, he says nothing, but the expression on his face and the movements of his body create a perfect, delightful moment. Gene Hackman and Estelle Parsons play Buck and Blanche Barrow, the other members of the gang, as inarticulate, simple, even good-willed. When Buck is reunited with his kid brother, they howl with glee and punch each other to disguise the truth that they have nothing to say. This is pretty clearly the best American film of the year. It is also a landmark. Years from now, it is quite possible that Bonnie and Clyde will be seen as the definitive film of the 1960s, showing with sadness, humor, and unforgiving detail what one society has come to. The fact that the story is set 35 years ago doesn't mean a thing. It had to be set sometime. But it was made now, and it's about us. And that's the end of Ebert's review. And that is why Roger Ebert was arguably the greatest movie critic of all time. He was often way ahead of his time in many of his reviews. And Bonnie and Clyde is a perfect example of that. Everything he wrote in 1967 at the time rings true today about the admiration of this film. As a matter of fact, Roger Ebert had only been a film critic for 6 months when he first saw Bonnie and Clyde. Now, the first time I saw Bonnie and Clyde was in a film class I took in college. Taking that film class was one of the best decisions I ever made in my college career. I saw so many classic films, and to be able to analyze each film was an amazing experience. If college isn't in the cards for you, well, feel free to use my collection as a guide. It's far cheaper, and I won't even require you to write a paper on each film. Just enjoy them. Alright, let's get into the making of the film. So screenwriter Robert Benton was working for Esquire magazine when he and fellow screenwriter David Newman were reading a novel about the Dillinger days. and there was a small footnote about Bonnie and Clyde in it. It said not only were they outlaws, but outcasts, and that drew them both to a potential story about the infamous duo. The screenwriters pitched their Bonnie and Clyde script to the famous French film director François Truffaut, believing his style of filmmaking would suit a new era of movies. However, Truffaut was working on Fahrenheit 451. Also around this time, Warren Beatty approached Truffaut about working on a film about Edith Piaf. It was then Truffaut mentioned Benton and Newman and their Bonnie and Clyde script, and that Beatty might be interested in it. Beatty loved the script and bought the rights to it, but didn't believe he would be the one that actually played the lead role of Clyde. So even though Truffaut wasn't available, Beatty believed that American director Arthur Penn would be right for the film. Beatty had made a film with Penn called Mickey One in 1965. Penn had also directed The Miracle Worker about Helen Keller, and that starred Anne Bancroft and Patty Duke. However, Penn turned down Beatty initially. Beatty then offered the film to countless big-name directors like George Stevens, William Wyler, and others. Much of the criticism for the directors who turned down the film was the lack of likable characters in the film. Well, yeah, they're outlaws. Finally, Arthur Penn agreed to do the film, though he was worried it was just going to be another gangster film, like in the past. And many things about the initial script were adjusted, including the C.W. Moss character, which originally was like a threesome of sorts for Bonnie and Clyde. The original script called for the Clyde character to be bisexual. Penn convinced the screenwriters to adjust their thinking about this for a few different reasons, as the film was coming from a heterosexual point of view, along with the fact that in the mid-1960s, even though times were changing, audiences simply weren't ready to see a big-name actor playing a gay role. This is why there are subtle hints in the film that the Clyde character might not be fully straight, but it's never explicitly said. And frankly, being subtle in films is always better, in my opinion. Leave it up to the audience, is what I say. At the time, Faye Dunaway was very early on in her career. This was the first major script that was given to her, and she had appeared in two small films and two TV shows. Frankly, as history showed, the Bonnie character was a career-making role for Dunaway. Originally, before Beatty agreed to star in the film, he wanted his sister Shirley MacLaine to play Bonnie, but that had to be changed once he became the lead. Beatty also produced the film, which was unheard of at the time, having actors also produce films. Other actresses that were up for the Bonnie role included Jane Fonda, Tuesday Weld, Anne Margaret, Sharon Tate, Leslie Caron, Natalie Wood, Sue Lyon, and Cher. Beatty really wanted Natalie Wood, whom he had a relationship with at the time, but she had a difficult time working with Beatty on the 1961 film Splendor in the Grass, and sadly, she attempted suicide after a breakup with Beatty and was in recovery for years. Beatty felt Arthur Penn would like Dunaway, as she had the look he was going for, and he set up an audition for her. Penn indeed wanted Dunaway for the role, but Beatty was hesitant, not thinking that she was right. He had to be convinced, and Arthur Penn convinced him, and Beatty admits she was perfect to play Bonnie. Before filming started, Faye Dunaway was told to lose 25 pounds off her 5'7 frame. For weeks, she fasted except for an occasional salad and walked around wearing a 12-pound weight belt with smaller weights around her wrist to help her burn the pounds off faster. She only took off the weights to sleep and bathe. Now, for narrative's sake, the screenwriters decided to take three people that the real Bonnie and Clyde picked up to join them on their crime spree and combine them into one character, and that character was C.W. Moss. Beatty knew Michael J. Pollard from his beginning days as an actor, and he knew that he would be perfect for the C.W. role. Beatty also worked with Gene Hackman early on in Hackman's first movie called Lilith in 1964, and he loved working with him. Beatty really pushed for Hackman to play his brother in Bonnie and Clyde because he meshed so well with him. At that point, Hackman was pretty much an unknown. He only appeared in stage plays and some TV shows. While the film itself is held in high regard, it's also the fashion shown in the film that really stood out as well, especially the clothing designs pulled off perfectly by Faye Dunaway. I mean, when you think of the female gangster, Dunaway as Bonnie Parker is what you would dress up as today. The beret she wore in the film was kind of the coup de grace. Initially, the film was not a box office smash. And while many critics, like Roger Ebert, enjoyed the film, a few important critics really panned the film. And this was due to the intense violence, which was simply not seen in films at that point. However, a few critics changed their mind and reassessed their original reviews, and Warren Beatty pressured Warner Brothers to re-release the film. And really, this was an unprecedented move at the time. At first, the studio CEO, Elliot Hyman, said he would only do it if Beatty agreed to a cut in his profit participation. When Beatty threatened to sue, hinting that he knew more about Hyman's business dealings than he did, the bluff worked. The film went back into theaters a few weeks later. A screening for Jack L. Warner went very badly for Warren Beatty and Arthur Penn. Warner got up 3 times to pee. Warner initially dumped the film into drive-ins and second-run theaters and apparently went to his grave still hating the film. Warner Brothers had so little faith in this film that they offered the first-time producer Beatty 40% of the gross instead of a minimal fee. And as I said, the film went on to gross over $70 million. He did pretty well. All right, let's get into the film. So it begins with a montage of old photographs while the title credits appear. We then get a quick bio of our main characters. Bonnie Parker was born in Rowena, Texas in 1910 and then moved to West Dallas. In 1931, she worked at a cafe before beginning her career in crime. Clyde Barrow was born to a family of sharecroppers. As a young man, he became a small-time thief and robbed a gas station. He served 2 years for armed robbery and was released on good behavior in 1931. We then cut to Bonnie, that's Faye Dunaway, who's lying nude on her bed. She then sees a man outside of her window trying to rob her mother's car. And yes, it's Clyde, Warren Beatty.
Hey, boy! What you doing with my mama's car? Wait there! Ain't you ashamed? You're trying to steal an old lady's automobile.
Oh, come on now, what you talking about? I've been thinking about buying me one.
Bull. You ain't got money for dinner, let alone buy no car.
Now, man, I tell you something. I got enough money for Coca-Cola. And, since it don't look like you're gonna invite me inside.
Oh, you'd see at the dining room table if I did.
Well, you won't go in town with me? How'd that be?
I'm going to work anyway.
You going to work, huh?
Yeah.
What kind of work you do?
None of your business.
I bet you're a movie star. A lady mechanic?
No.
Maid?
What do you think I am?
A waitress.
What line of work you in? When you're not stealing cars.
Well, I tell you, I'm looking for suitable employment right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, what'd you do before?
I was in state prison.
State prison?
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess, some little old lady wasn't so nice.
It was armed robbery.
Mama. The things that turn up in the street these days.
Hey. What y'all do for a good time around here? Listen to the grass grow?
I guess you had a lot more fun up at state prison, huh?
I tell you, see my right foot?
Yeah.
I chopped 2 toes off that foot with an axe.
What? Why?
To get off a work detail. You won't see it?
No. I surely don't intend to stand here in the middle of Main Street and look at your dirty feet. Boy, did you really do that?
Prison?
No. Armed robbery.
Ain't like anything.
Shoot, I knew you never robbed the place, you faker. Yeah. you wouldn't have the gumption to use it.
All right. You just wait right here and you keep your eyes open.
And just like that, the most famous criminal couple is now in business. Bonnie is often giving her naturally seductive looks, and it's obvious that the excitement of being a criminal turns her on. However, Clyde rebuffs her advances towards the end of that clip. As he puts it, he's not much of a lover boy. Read into that as you may, though he's definitely sure to clarify he's not into guys either. However, he does his best to convince Bonnie that she could make it big if she partners up with him.
You're born somewhere around East Texas, right?
Yeah.
You come from a big old family?
Yeah.
You went to school, of course, but you didn't take to it much because you was a lot smarter than everybody else, so you just up and quit one day. Now, when you were 16, you... 17, there was a guy who worked in a
cement plant.
Right, cement plant. And you liked him because he thought you were just as nice as you could be. And you almost married that guy. But then you thought, no, you didn't think you would. So then you got your job in the cafe. And now you wake up every morning, you hate it. You just hate it. You get on down there and you put on your white uniform.
Pink.
It's pink. Uh-huh. And them truck drivers come in there to eat your greasy burgers and they kid you and you kid them back. But there's stupid and dumb boys with the big old tattoos on them and you don't like it. And they ask you for dates and sometimes you go, but you mostly don't because all they're ever trying to do is get in your pants whether you want them to or not. So you go on home and you sit in your room and you think, now when and how am I ever going to get away from this? And now you know. Change that. I don't like it.
In this one.
I don't mean we have to go home in it.
That's right, first armed robbery, next Grand Theft Auto. The couple wake up the next day in an abandoned farmhouse.
Clyde? Clyde?
Hey, lady.
Oh, hey. Where you been keeping yourself?
Oh, I slipped out by the car.
Oh, these accommodations ain't particularly deluxe.
If they're after us, I want the first shot. Now, you come on out here. We got some work to do.
You're good.
I ain't good. I'm the best.
And modest.
Can I see that there now? Is that her spin? No. Set or spin. It's all right. Come on now, try it again. Now this time come down slow. Slow. All right. How about that now? Ain't you something?
I tell you. Look, I'm gonna get you Smith and Wesson. Gonna go on your hand easy, don't you?
Yeah.
Now, I want you to try something now.
And you? No, sir. No, sir. Y'all go right ahead. Used to be my place. But he's not anymore. Bank took it. Yes, sir, they moved us off. Now it belongs to them.
Well, that's a pitiful shame.
You're damn right, ma'am. Me and him put in the years here. Yes, sir. You all go right ahead. We just come by for a last look. Hey, Davis, come on over here. That's right. Gone. Much obliged. My name's Otis Harris. This is Davis. We work this place.
How you? This here's Miss Bonnie Parker.
Glad to meet you.
I'm Clyde Barron.
Clyde.
Nobody!
We robbed banks.
Clyde let the ex-owner of the house shoot up the foreclosed sign in the front of his house put up by the bank. And by saying they're bank robbers, I can't imagine the former owner of the house is too broken up about the banks getting robbed. The couple is soon back on the road and continuing their pursuit of committing as many crimes as possible, though it doesn't always go as planned.
Look, I don't want you to worry about nothing. This is going to be the easiest thing in the world. Your mama could take this bank. All right. Just be ready if I need you.
What are you waiting for?
It's a stick up. You just take it easy and nothing's gonna happen to you.
Daddy.
Give me the money. Give me the money.
What money, mister? There ain't no money here.
What you talking about? This here's a bank, ain't it?
It was a bank, but we failed 3 weeks ago.
All right, now you get on out of here. Come on out of here! Get on out there and tell my girl. Come on, you tell her.
Oh,
We got $1.98 and you're laughing. Let's see now. Loaf of bread, a dozen eggs, quarter milk, four fried pies. Come on now, you sure you ain't got no peach pies? I don't believe you.
Seeing some bitch come up on you with a meat cleaver. I ain't against him.
Quaid fought off the guy with a meat cleaver and it's back on the road.
Tell me what was wrong with that boy.
Dirt.
Dirt?
Dirt in the fuel line. Just blowed it away. Excuse me, ma'am. Is there anything else I could do for you today?
You're a smart fella. You sure do know a lot about automobiles, don't you?
Yes, I guess I do.
Well, would you know what kind of car this is?
This is a four-cylinder Ford coupe?
No.
Sure is.
This is a stolen four-cylinder Ford coupe.
Hey, you ain't scared, are you? Huh?
I believe he is.
Well, that's a pity now. We sure could have used a smart boy like that who knows such a great deal about automobiles. Hey, you a good driver, boy?
Yeah, reckon I am.
No, you'd better off here.
What's your name, boy?
C.W. Moss.
Well, I'm Miss Bonnie Parker, and this here's Mr. Clyde Barrow. We rob banks.
Hey, now, there ain't nothing wrong with that, is there?
Oh,
no. Uh-oh, Clyde, he ain't the one. Let's go.
Wait. Hey, boy. You think you got the guts for our line of work?
What are you talking about? I spent a year in reformatory.
Woo-hoo, a man with a record.
Well, I know you got the nerve to shortchange old ladies who are coming in for gas. What I'm asking you is, have you got what it takes to pull bank jobs with us?
Mr. C.W. Moss.
Sure do. I ain't afraid. That's what you think.
Prove it.
Hmm.
And just like that, there's a third member to the gang. A C.W. Moss, played by Michael J. Pollard, decides to steal the cash from the service station and go on the road with Bonnie and Clyde. In the meantime, the guy with the meat cleaver from the grocery store is in the hospital being shown mugshots by the police officers trying to catch the man that attacked him. With C.W. in tow, he's now the getaway car driver. However, after Bonnie and Clyde rob a bank, C.W. moves the car to a different parking space while the couple are dumbfounded where C.W. was. They eventually find the car, but C.W. crashes into multiple cars before getting away. However, the bank manager tries to jump on the car, and Clyde shoots and kills the man. Clyde berates C.W. while they hide out in a movie theater, and later Clyde tries to protect Bonnie by saying she should just get out of this now. However, she's too much into the exciting lifestyle of a wanted fugitive to bail out now. We also discover what Clyde meant by not being a, quote, lover boy. He's basically impotent. Though it's never specifically called out, it's strongly implied. The next day, we meet Clyde's older brother, Buck, played by Gene Hackman, and his sister-in-law, Blanche, played by Estelle Parsons.
Come on! Oh, boy, you better not!
Hey, how's Mama?
Fine.
Sister?
Tell the best to you.
Don't have to. We almost beat up prison food.
No. It's married life. And you know what they say. It's the face powder that gets a man interested. Yeah. But it's the bacon powder that keeps him home. I want you to meet my wife, Blanche.
Blanche, this is my baby brother.
How do you do? It's real nice to know you.
How do you do?
Hey, Barney! Hey, wait, is this... Ooh, boy! Is this Barney? Yeah, I hear you taking real good care of the baby in the family, huh? Hey, sis, I'm just so glad to meet you. Come on over here. I want you to meet my wife, Blanche. Blanche! This here's Barney.
Hi. Hello.
Hey, everybody. This is C.W. Moss. Brother Buck and his wife, Blanche.
Howdy, everybody. Howdy, y'all. Howdy, Mrs. Barrow. Oh, may I call you Blanche? Hey, well, I sure am pleased to meet you. How'd you find us here in the neck of the woods? Boy, you sure picked a good day for it. Well, is that a new Screenland magazine? Is there any new pictures of Myrna Loy in there? She's my favorite picture star. May I?
Hey there, let me get the Kodak here. We'll take some pictures.
Come on, put your pants on, boy. We're going to take some pictures.
Come on, Blanche. Get out of there. Hold on to her there.
Did you take my picture back? Well, I declare, I asked you not to take my picture.
Hey, Buck, get one of this.
Hey, brother, I want to talk to you later on.
You devil, you. Hold it.
You got that?
Yeah. Hey, now, you take one of me and my missus here, Clyde.
All right.
Honey, I don't want it.
Come on.
Honestly, I don't want it.
Come on,
come on over here. Come on, look over there at the birdie.
Honey, I didn't do it, Bud.
Give old...
Come on, now, be serious. Be serious.
Oh, still.
Oh,
hey,
let
me take one of Bonnie alone. Come on, honey. Huh?
Okay.
All right, now.
Oh, honey. Hey, come on now, little smile. Little smile.
Hey. Come on, I want to have a chat with you. Come on.
C.W., you take girl's picture.
Why don't you step in there with Bonnie?
What do you think of her?
Bonnie? She's a peach. Now, tell me true. Is she as good as she looks?
She's better.
Hey, listen, it was either you or him, wasn't it?
What?
The guy that you killed, you had to do it, didn't you? It was either you or him.
You put me on the spot. What? I had to.
You had to do it,
right? I had to. I knew you did.
Don't say anything to Blanche about that.
Aw. Time you broke out of jail, that's true. She talked you into going back.
Yeah, and you hear about that?
Huh? That true?
Yeah.
Well, I won't say nothing to Bonnie about it.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Okay.
What are we gonna do?
Well, how's this? I figured we all drive up Missouri. They ain't looking for me up there. We find a nice little place to hole up in. We have us a regular vacation. Right?
No trouble now.
Oh, I ain't looking to go back to no prison.
I heard in prison that you had a little trouble there. You was cutting on your toes.
You heard about that?
Yeah, well, I did a little toe cutting.
That ain't but half of it. I did it so I could get off of work detail, you know, breaking them damn rocks with a sledgehammer night and day. And you know what? The very next week I get paroled. I walk out of that godforsaken jail on crutches. Ain't life grand?
Your story about the boy he owned the dairy pharmacy. Well, his old ma, she was kind of sick, you know. And the doctor, he called him over and said, listen, your ma, she's lying there, she's just so sick and she's weakly, and I want you to try to persuade her to take a little brandy, see? Just to pick her spirits up, you know. And ma's a teetotaler, he says, that she wouldn't touch a drop.
Well, I'll tell you what you do, that's the doc. I'll tell you what you do. bring in a fresh quart of milk every day, and you put some brandy in it, see? And you try that. So he did, and he doctored it all up with the brandy, the fresh milk, and he gave it to his mama, and she drank a little bit of it. She didn't, you know. So next day he brought in again, and she drank a little more, you know. And so they went on that way for the third day, just a little more, and the fourth day she was, you know, took a little bit more, and then finally 1 week later. He gave her the milk and she just drank it down, boy. She swallowed the whole thing, you know. And she called him over and she said, son, whatever you do, don't sell that cow. Don't sell the cow.
Bonnie gets a bit stir-crazy at the hideout with Buck, Blanche, and CW. It's obvious she's only happy and excited when they're on the run. She gets her wish soon enough after a grocery store delivery boy recognizes Bonnie.
Okay. Here, ma'am, let me help you. Those bags are heavy.
No, thanks. I'll get them. Just get the door.
Bud, look at Bonnie. Get that.
Shh. Stay up down there.
Close the door.
But few of them really are justified. If you get right down to the point, you've heard of a woman's glory being spent on a downright curve.
Did you write all that yourself?
And you want to hear this or not? Kerr, still you can't always judge the story as true being told by her. Now, Sal was a gal of rare beauty, though her features were coarse and tough.
I knew that old gal. She was cockeyed and she had her hair left and them no teeth.
Hey, Buck, come on now. Go ahead.
Now, Sal was a gal of rare beauty, though her features were coarse and tough. She never once faltered from duty to play on the up and up. Sal told me this tale on the evening before she was turned out free. And I'll do my best to relate it just as she told
me. Hey. The laws are outside. They're blocking the driveway.
Thank you.
shouldn't have done that, Blanche. It was a dumb thing to do.
Oh, Arthur, please. I didn't marry you to see you get shot at. Please, let's go. Let's leave. Let's get out of here and leave town. Please make it stop. The car. Let it stop.
I can't. Oh. I killed a guy. Now we're in this.
Please!
Just shut up! Just shut up, your big mouth. At least do that much. Will you just shut
up? Shut up, buddy!
You stop the car. I want to talk to you. They get rid of her.
I can't get rid of her. She bucks wild.
Well, they get rid of them both.
Why? What's the matter with you anyway?
She is what's the matter with me. She's on the middle of dumb, stupid backcountry.
Now, you look.
She ain't got a brain in her head.
What makes you any better? What makes you so damn special? You were just a West Dallas waitress and spent half your time picking up truck drivers.
Human! Oh, big Clyde Barrow! You're just like a brother.
Uh-huh.
Ignorant, uneducated hillbilly. Listen, the only special thing about you is your peculiar ideas about lovemaking, which is no lovemaking at all. No. Please, I didn't mean that. Listen, it was just all the shooting. It's all those guns. I got so scared. Please, honey, I didn't mean it.
Now, that ambush was based on a real-life shootout where the police believe they were bootleggers hiding out. But then it was discovered it was the infamous criminal couple. In real life, Blanche Barrow did not run from the Joplin apartment screaming with a spatula. In fact, she helped Clyde push one of the police cars out of the driveway, which was downhill. The car started rolling faster and rolled across the street into a large tree. They were dragged by the momentum, and that's what witnesses saw. Clyde was shot at the time, and Blanche let out a yelp and kept moving to get out of the line of fire. That was the last shot as the officer shooting ran out of ammo, so Buck called her back and she returned to get into the escape car in front of the apartment rather than being picked up down the street, as the movie portrayed. So we go back to the film. While Bonnie is often cool under pressure, Blanche is a hysterical mess. Eventually, Blanche calms down a bit. After pulling off to the side of the road, which they believe is deserted, they are found by a Texas Ranger who noticed the car.
Anderson was held up as an example for every other Texas police officer.
Sheriff! Wahoo! Wahoo! I never seen that shooting!
All right. Detain him. All right, now you just get on right over that car.
Well, now, look here. We're in the custody of Captain Frank Hammer. And Frank here is a Texas Ranger.
Sure enough is.
Hey there, peacemaker. I believe you got your spurs all tangled up there, haven't you? Huh? You're in Missouri. Do you know that, friend? Huh?
You know you're in Missouri?
He's lost this here Texas Ranger.
I don't think he's lost. Them banks been offering extra reward money for us, and I think Frank just figured on some easy pickings, didn't you, Frank? You know, Texas Ranger, you ain't hardly doing your job.
You ought to be home protecting the rats of poor folk, not out chasing after us.
We're looking out for the poor folks.
What do you want to take it so personal for?
Well, we gotta discourage this here bounty hunting for the bear again.
Well,
huh?
What do you want to do with him then? Shoot him?
No.
Come on now.
Huh? Hang him. I don't know.
Take his picture.
Huh?
Huh?
Take his picture.
Listen, we take his picture, we send it to all the newspapers, and then everybody's going to see Captain Frank Hammer of the Texas Rangers with the Barrow Gang, and all of us just as friendly as pie.
Now, you know, we are just about the friendliest folks you would ever want to meet.
Big old Texas Ranger waves his gun at us, and we just welcome him like he was one of our own.
Hey, Buck.
Yeah?
Get the Kodak.
Hot doggies! Get him up there on a spare tack, right?
All right. There we go, my friend. Now, see what come of your mischief? Yeah. Not doing your job. You know, down in Duncanville last year, poor farmers kept you laws away from us with shotguns. Now, you supposed to be protecting them from us and they protecting us from you. That don't make sense, do it?
You and Bonnie first. Now, get right in there. Now, go on, friendly like, you know.
When his Texas Ranger friends see this, you're going to wish he was dead.
Well, we're mighty proud to have a Texas Ranger in the family.
Hold it, hold it.
How's this?
Yeah. Oh, good, good, good. I'm getting it. Wait, hold it.
How about that?
You bastard!
We got you! You just stand there for a while! We're gonna use that picture! We got you! We're gonna use you, boy! We got you! Dude.
This is about our gang. Now, if everybody will just take it easy, nobody will get hurt. Is that your money or the bank's?
Mine.
All right. You keep it, then. Next time, I'll aim a little lower.
I'm Buck Barrel.
For the Barrel Boys! Happy birthday, hon!
After spitting on Bonnie, they put the sheriff in a canoe and left him in the lake before robbing another bank. Bonnie and Clyde, along with others, are now full-blown celebrities, and for some people, they're folk heroes. For example, the older gentleman, whom Clyde let keep his own money because it wasn't the bank's, is interviewed by the paper, and he says he harbors no ill feelings towards the gang since they did right by him. I suppose Bonnie and Clyde were the original cyber hackers who hack for good, like Anonymous. After evading the police in another car chase, their car is worse for wear after being shot up. It's time to steal another car. This time, it's the vehicle of a young couple, played by Gene Wilder in his film debut, and Evans Evans. Yes, that's really her name.
You stop that now. Come on. Stop that, Eugene. Say, isn't that your car, Eugene?
That's my car.
Hey! That's my car! Hey! That's my car!
They're coming after us.
Come on, kick in the pants.
Yeah. I'm gonna tear them apart. Those punks stealing a man's car. Right. Wait till I get my hands on those kids, Velma. I'm gonna tear them apart.
What if they have guns, Eugene?
Listen, we better get the police and let them handle this.
Right.
All right, now turn around. Turn around, let's go back to town, and we'll go get the sheriff.
They stopped chasing us.
Hey, they're turning around there.
Let's take them.
Oh, my Lord, they're coming after us.
Step on it, Velma. Velma, step on it, Velma. Step on it, Velma.
I am. What do you want to do that so bad?
Step on it, Velma. Step on it, Velma.
Come on.
Velma, step on it, Velma. Velma, step on it.
What's your names?
I'm Eugene Grizzard.
And I'm Velma Davis.
Well, we're the Barrel Gang. That there's Clyde driving. I'm Buck. That's my wife, Blanche. Bonnie Parker, CW.
Oh, now listen, y'all. Don't be scared. I mean, it ain't like you was the law or anything like that. I mean, just folks, just like us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the truth.
I expect you've been reading about us.
Oh, yeah. No.
Yes. We have two.
Well, now, you two must be in love, I bet, huh?
Now, boy, when are you going to marry the girl?
Back.
He gave her the milk, see, and she drank a little bit of it, and the next day he gave her some more, and she drank a little more until 1 week goes by, see, and he brings in the milk, and she drinks down every drop of it, and she looks at her son, she calls him over, and she says, son, whatever you do, don't sell that cow. Don't sell the cow.
I'm from Wisconsin originally. Where the cheese comes from.
Oh, but he just loves Texas now. Oh. Don't you, Eugene?
Don't sell that cow.
Hey, how old are you, honey?
I'm 33.
French fries. Yeah, you did. Yeah. Hey, everybody, you.
Now take it easy on them French fries, Velma. Ain't that right, Gene?
This is in mine. I ordered mine well done. Who's got the other hamburger?
Oh, is this supposed to be yours?
It's okay. Forget it.
Hey, I'm sure having a good time. Aren't you glad we picked you up? Huh?
You're a grand host, bud.
Maybe you all want to join up with us.
Oh, boy, they sure would be surprised to hear that back home.
What would Bill and Martha say if they heard that?
Lordy, they would have a fit.
Hey, what do you do anyhow?
I'm an undertaker.
Get them out of here.
Well, Joke's over quickly as Bonnie didn't see the humor in bringing an undertaker into the gang, as she obviously believes it's an ominous sign of things to come, as the current criminal lifestyle isn't a high success rate for living. Also, there's a great visual gag when Velma says she's 33. Eugene's face drops, as it's obvious she lied about her age to him prior. So the Gene Wilder and Evans scene is based on the kidnappings of Undertaker H.D. Darby and his acquaintance Sophia Stone near Ruston, Louisiana on the late afternoon of April 27, 1933, but done by the Barrow Gang, who had stolen their car. They were both released unharmed several hours later. According to Darby, one of the Barrow Gang members asked what he did for a living, and when he replied that he was an undertaker, Bonnie Parker allegedly said to him in a sarcastic tone, "You may have to work on me someday." The following year, H.D. Darby was indeed one of the coroners that worked on Bonnie and Clyde after they had been killed by the police. Sorry, spoiler alert. Alright, there's about 45 minutes left and plenty of crazy action left. You may or may not know the real-life tale of Bonnie and Clyde, so I won't spoil anything regarding this film. Obviously, you know the outcome, but the ending scene is still powerful today to watch. And while the movie definitely takes more liberties than a modern-day biopic would, this film is absolutely one of the best ever made simply because of the acting talent. Here's a perfect example where the story might not be 100% accurate, but it really just doesn't matter because of today's actors, they couldn't hold a candle to Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway, Gene Hackman, and Gene Wilder. It's also a film that set a new tone for grittier and darker tone to films than ever before. Not since the pre-code gangster films was a movie as violent as Bonnie and Clyde. And while it may seem somewhat tame today, it definitely wasn't in 1967, and future filmmakers of the crime genre were definitely influenced by this film. Also, the world at large was ready for more violent films, especially since the Vietnam War was raging at this point in history. Alright, there were a couple of deleted scenes. One is called The Road to Mineola. CW, Bonnie, and Clyde are eating at a diner, and Bonnie is disgusted by CW's eating habits in which he puts sugar on everything. Clyde then pours sugar on the table and maps out their next bank robbery. They will later head to Mineola, Texas. The next one is called Outlaws. So while CW is taking a bath, Bonnie poses and sings in the mirror, "We're in the money," after yet another holdup. Clyde also takes Bonnie aside in an attempt to try to protect her because he's killed another man, and maybe that she should probably go out on her own and not be caught with him. This is similar to another scene that actually made the film. All right, I'm actually going to give you the kind of the Cliff Notes version of the real-life Bonnie and Clyde. So the movie was factual about Bonnie being a waitress and Clyde being an ex-con from Dallas. Both fell in love quickly, and for 2 years they went on one of the most infamous crime sprees in American history, and this was across 5 states. So it was Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, and Louisiana. Now the police at the time wanted nothing more than to kill Bonnie and Clyde, not just capture. The couple were cop killers, and you know how well that sits with the police. Clyde's family was poor and included 6 children, and they had to give up farming and move to Dallas when Clyde was 12. Dallas was the place struggling farmers went to try to survive. By the age of 16, Clyde quit school and followed his older brother's footsteps and became a small-time criminal. First, by keeping a rental car instead of returning it, and later was arrested for buying stolen turkeys. He then started stealing cars and increased his robberies. Bonnie moved to the suburb of Dallas when she was 4 after her father died. Like Clyde, they were a very poor family. Bonnie did graduate high school, though, and was known to be very attractive and kind and worked as a waitress. She married at 16, but her husband was physically abusive, and he was an alcoholic and was arrested and sent to prison for a bank robbery. Even though she ended up leaving him, they never officially got divorced and continued to wear her wedding ring her entire life, even after she met Clyde. Now, the timing was perfect for Bonnie to meet Clyde, as she was finished with her husband and looking to break out of her stagnant life. Bonnie was 19 and Clyde was 20. The couple were with each other almost all of the time for 2 weeks straight before he was finally arrested. Clyde was sentenced to 2 years in prison for 5 auto thefts. However, Clyde couldn't handle not being around Bonnie and decided he needed to break out of prison. With the help of Bonnie, who smuggled a gun into prison, Clyde did indeed escape. However, he was recaptured 2 weeks later in Minnesota. He was then retried and sentenced to 14 years. The couple did remain in a relationship and corresponded through letters. After 14 months in a prison farm, and not satisfied that his mother couldn't budge the parole board to shave off time for his sentence, Clyde decided to chop off 2 of his toes in order to get off work detail. That part of the story in the film was indeed factual. Ironically, there was no need for Clyde to mutilate himself, as his mother and sister actually got the governor to pardon his sentence 2 weeks later and he was released. When he was released, he was more of a hardened person than before, no longer a happy-go-lucky. He even tried to get legitimate work. He would indeed have jobs, but it was during the Depression when cutbacks occurred. Clyde was always the first to get let go, mostly because he was an ex-con, and the police would show up, making sure the bosses knew about his criminal history. Clyde just gave up trying to find legit work. And part of the reason Bonnie and Clyde became folk heroes to some was indeed due to the financial ruin of many people during the Great Depression of the 1930s. The couple were fighting back against the system that ruined the lives for many families, especially by robbing banks, who many felt were the cause of the economic downturn. Bonnie and Clyde were like Robin Hood figures, along with John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd, Ma Barker's gang, Machine Gun Kelly, Babyface Nelson, and they were all the new era of gangsters, unlike the mobsters like Al Capone. However, Bonnie and Clyde were not criminal masterminds. They never planned their robberies, and often committed their crimes on whims when the moment hit them. As you can imagine, this was an incredibly sloppy way of doing business, even illegal business. They would just rob places when they were low on cash, and they netted very little because they didn't plan out the best places to score a lot of cash. Also, they were often risking their lives for very little return. But Clyde fancied himself as a modern-day Jesse James. It was about the prestige of being an outlaw, not how much wealth his robberies gave him. And often, he would not try to shoot or kill innocent victims. He often captured and released even police officers. Bonnie was even sent to jail on her own in a role reversal, though later she was released for lack of evidence. And Clyde kept up his criminal ways with another partner named Raymond Hamilton. As I stated earlier, the C.W. Moss character in the film is a combination of multiple people from history, including Hamilton, Ralph Fultz, and W.D. Jones. Clyde also realized there was no turning back at this point. He was going to be a high-profile criminal no matter what he did. If he was caught, he was going to the electric chair, so why stop now? Even though Bonnie and Clyde were making headlines, they weren't living the life of luxury. They often camped out in the woods and fields to survive. Through all of this, the couple would still find opportunities to see their family, finding creative ways to set up the meetings. Clyde would put a note in an empty Coke bottle and then throw it out of his car window while driving to his father's service station, and then they would arrange their meeting that way without Clyde being noticed. Okay, obviously we know the outcome of their crime spree, but this was just a quick overview of the real-life Bonnie and Clyde. But I really recommend checking out documentaries and books about the duo if you want a more in-depth biography. Alright, some fun facts. The film was nominated for almost every Oscar category, along with every main actor in the film. It was nominated for Best Picture, but it lost to In the Heat of the Night. Arthur Penn was nominated for Best Director, but he lost to Mike Nichols for The Graduate. Warren Beatty was nominated for Best Actor, but lost to Rod Steiger in The Heat of the Night. Faye Dunaway was nominated for Best Actress. She lost to Katharine Hepburn for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Gene Hackman and Michael J. Pollard were nominated for Best Supporting Actor. They lost to George Kennedy in Cool Hand Luke. Estelle Parsons won for Best Supporting Actress. The Best Screenplay that was written for screen lost to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. The Best Costume Design lost to Camelot. It did win Best Cinematography. If you didn't know, in the film, Faye Dunaway's double was Morgan Fairchild. Originally, Arthur Penn wanted to shoot the film in black and white. And while I love some modern films that were shot in black and white, like Raging Bull, I think the impact of this particular film was much better in color with the new era of violence. Also, Warner Brothers was no longer making black and white films. Gene Hackman was on set one day when he noticed a guy standing behind him and staring. The man said, "Hell, Buck would have never worn a hat like that." Hackman turned around and looked at him and said, "Maybe not." The man looked like an old Texas farmer. The man introduced himself and said, "Nice to meet you. I'm one of the Barrows." Michael J. Pollard didn't realize that in the eating scenes, you don't actually eat all the food because of the possibility of repeated takes. Sure enough, he soon regretted it. In the scene in which the outlaws kidnap the couple and eat at their lunch in the car, by the 12th take, Pollard was decidedly feeling ill because he had already eaten 12 whole hamburgers. In planning their performance, Faye Dunaway wanted to wear slacks as Bonnie Parker, since the character would need to move freely to race in and out of getaway cars. In contrast, costume designer Theodora Van Runkel suggested a more glamorous look with long skirts, a beret, and a short jacket. The Bonnie and Clyde look became all the fashion rage, and for many years afterward, Dunaway would insist on having Van Runkel design her costumes. The real Blanche Barrow sued Warner Brothers over the way she was depicted in the film. In reality, Barrow was the same age as Bonnie Parker, and arguably better looking than her. She was not a preacher's daughter and had married Buck knowing that he was an escaped prisoner and twice divorced. Before deciding to play the role, Warren Beatty's first choice of the role of Clyde Barrow was Bob Dylan. who actually resembled the actual Beryl more strongly than Beatty. In real life, Bonnie Parker was 4'10", 9 inches shorter than Faye Dunaway. The legendary outlaw John Dillinger had a very low opinion of Clyde Beryl and Bonnie Parker, calling them punks who are giving bank robbers a bad name. Well, someone who doesn't give this podcast a bad name is Joseph Staub, who loves this movie and he loves this film history, and we talk about this, frankly, game-changing movie of the late 1960s. So let's discuss Bonnie and Clyde, and then I'll be back next week to talk about yet another random movie from my DVD collection. Okay, we're back with Joseph Staub, a longtime guest, and it's always great to have him on. And welcome back, Joseph.
Thanks for having me, Brian. I always love to be on.
All right, so this is a good one. So most of the time we do kind of like early films in black and white, but this one, even though it's, I would still consider the classic era, I would say up till 1970s is or 65 at least would be, you know, the classic era. This came out in 1967 and this changed everything. So prior to seeing this film, had you actually heard about the legend of Bonnie and Clyde? And if not, after watching the film, did you of course do some research about the real life couple? Because, you know, when you saw this, the internet was around.
Yeah. So I feel like even before I had actually seen the film itself, it's just kind of in the public consciousness, like the term Bonnie and Clyde and kind of that idea. So like I had heard the term before, I never really had placed it much. This film, and then I think it was a big thing a couple years ago, the History Channel did something with Bonnie and Clyde. So it kind of brought everything back up then as well. But yeah, so like seeing the film and then doing my own research into it and kind of separating fact from fiction a little bit in terms of like, well, for example, like one of the characters is an amalgamation of a couple different real life people and all this different stuff. It really kind of, I kind of delved into a little bit because that's a really interesting period for me as far as historical films go. So like Depression era, both cinema made in and around the Depression era, but also cinema about that era. So stuff like this movie, The Untouchables, and other stuff like that, that kind of looks back, or The Sting or things like that.
Right.
That look back on that period are always some of my really kind of favorite eras of film to look back on, because especially that was, you see it a lot in like, I mean, this film was 67, The Sting was in the early 70s, Untouchables didn't come till later, 87, but it was based on the TV series from the 60s. So it was kind of like that era. You always kind of hear about looking back a few generations, so it was that kind of period, late 60s, early 70s, was really kind of looking back on the Depression era from that perspective, and you see that a lot. And I really get interested in that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you nailed it, especially like in the 80s, everything was from the 50s. So like they were trying to go back in that era. Yeah. And another tie-in is, so are you a fan of like early gangster films like with Edward G. Robinson and James Cagney?
Oh yeah, no, I love that stuff. Yeah, Little Caesar and the original Scarface and some of that stuff is just awesome movies. And I love looking back at that kind of stuff and seeing how they were portrayed at the time. Versus when you come back and the gangster films really, really got hot again with The Godfather and then all the films that Scorsese made, Mean Streets on down.
Right.
And you kind of see how or of course the remake of Scarface as well.
Oh, yeah.
But you kind of see how the gangster genre kind of evolved from where it was in the 30s, even in like foreign films, something like Fritz Lang's M.
Yep.
Or things like that versus how they'd be portrayed looking back, kind of like this film is looking back on that period. It's kind of interesting to see the difference on how gangsters were portrayed in their own time versus the kind of retrospective films of the 70s and 80s.
Well, especially the early 30s, before The Code, and you and I have talked about this, they could really be kind of almost portray the gangsters as heroes, where they had to stop that after The Code. And I think this is where Bonnie and Clyde kind of ushered in the new era of filmmaking, especially when it came to violence. So
yes,
they almost were portrayed as heroes, and it was okay because it was almost like, you know, audiences were savvy enough to realize, yeah, they are portrayed as heroes, but we're still not going to act like them. You know, watching the film today, were you surprised about how violent it was for a film released in 1967?
A little bit. Like, I mean, definitely kind of the ensuing years have definitely desensitized us, I think, to it.
Sure.
But then it's like, kind of like you said, remembering 67, and you look, there was a YouTube video I watched in kind of preparation for this after I watched the movie to talk, just kind of like to get some talking points and stuff. And one of the really comparisons they made was comparing this to some of the war films that were made around this same time.
Mm.
So something like The Longest Day,
yeah,
or some of the other war films that were being made in the 60s, which were relatively bloodless.
Mm-hmm.
Which, when you're talking about something like, as far as The Longest Day, you're talking about something like the Normandy landings.
Right.
You look at a film like Saving Private Ryan 30 years later, it's one of the bloodiest scenes in movie history.
Right.
Or Platoon. But how it was still treated in the 60s, where it was just, oh, they clutch their chest and they fall over.
Right.
And there's almost no blood. Whereas you look at this, and especially like the finals, or you have Gene Hackman getting his face blown off, or like the ending scene where it's just absolutely, they're absolutely getting riddled with bullets. And it's a very, mm-hmm. very bloody, but also a very, it's a very sexual film as well.
Oh, yeah.
And so you kind of see that a lot as well in the late 60s. I would compare, I'll compare the sexuality to something like maybe like In the Heat of the Night.
Yeah.
Where it's a very frank sexuality. It's not like they're not being coy about it. It pervades the entire film, really. And like, it's a repeated discussion point from the main characters as well as like their relationship and the nature of it. And sort of particularly the character of Bonnie kind of being pulled away by this sort of larger than life figure that she sees when she looks at Clyde, and like, wanting to be involved in this lifestyle and then not being fully satisfied, quite literally,
right,
by him, and like her making him out to be this larger than life figure, when in all reality he's just an everyday criminal that, when it comes down to it, quite literally can't perform.
That's right. And we're going to get into that, because there's all sorts of theories about it. What's interesting, you bring up like kind of the sexuality. I think it came out the same year, but Cool Hand Luke, you think the car washing scene and things like that. Mm-hmm. There's a certain tone where you can see how a film is kind of shifting. I'm Sam Peckinpah's films, mm-hmm. and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Wild Bunch is what, in 69, I think?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, you really could point to this film as really changing how Hollywood mm-hmm. went into the 70s.
Yeah. And what you said earlier kind of made me think also about like the glorification. You look at something like, and you would see this being used much more recently in The Sopranos, is The Public mm-hmm. Enemy.
Yeah. Yep.
And how that kind of glorifies gangsters, and how it's Tony Soprano's favorite movie.
Yep.
And like, it's basically saying, of course, his favorite movie is a film that glorifies the gangster lifestyle in a show that is very unglamorous about the gangster lifestyle. It's kind of similar in this, where it's like you see it subverts that expectation, where it's like throughout a lot of the film, it tempts you into thinking that it's going to glorify the gangster lifestyle, and then it just rips the rug out from under you. You see it through mainly through like the eyes of Michael J. Pollard's character,
right,
where he is kind of morphed by the gangster lifestyle, and then it takes his family, his father particularly, especially like when he sees the tattoo and everything like that, and it's hilarious.
Yep.
Where it's just like his reaction, and then that's like what flips the switch for him to go and coalesce with the authorities to set this trap for them. And then it just kind of rips the rug out from you at the end, where it's like, these are not characters to be glorified. These are not characters to be looked up to. And in the end, this is the only fate for those kind of characters.
Sure. And people forget, like, in this is the Depression era, you mentioned that. And so, you know, they were kind of anti-establishment. They were kind of taking it to the man, because they were robbing banks. And the banks are the ones that, if you look back and your mortgage got taken away from you, the banks were the man. So they were kind of sticking it to the banks. And there's even that scene, remember, when he gives the gun to the homeowner who's leaving because his, mm-hmm. his house got taken away, and he lets him shoot, you know, the house up.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, I think back then, people forget, they were kind of like folk heroes in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So film buffs are definitely aware of this film and they revere it, but I don't think it gets as much modern love that I think it deserves. Why do you think that is? Because the cast is stellar. I mean,
oh my gosh, yes.
I mean, Faye Dunaway, Gene Hackman, Gene Wilder, I mean, it introduced them to audiences. So why don't you think modern audiences don't really remember this film that much?
I think, and this is, like I mentioned in some of the YouTube videos I was watching, this is kind of a talking point, was kind of like you mentioned, it's kind of fallen off a little bit. Not only the film, but kind of the idea, the Bonnie and Clyde legend as mm-hmm. well, has sort of fallen off a little bit in modern times. I think a little bit of it has to do with that the Depression era is not the in thing, really. Mm-hmm. It's not like one of the big, like you've seen the return of Westerns, like you've seen like the kind of modern return of the Western genre. You've seen, I mean, action's never gone away, but like really in the last couple of years, the John Wick movies,
mm-hmm.
all that, the Mission Impossible movies really kind of have kept that in the public consciousness. Comedy as well is always kind of around. Superhero movies have definitely kind of come out of nowhere, but like this sort of film in general, I think, has kind of lost a lot of steam
mm-hmm.
in the modern day. And so more necessarily like maybe more character driven, this film in general doesn't really it subverts genre almost.
Yeah,
like it doesn't fit into any easy hole, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
As far as genre goes. And I think in general, you see that a lot. Music, movies, anything these days, people like specific things. Oh, I love superhero movies, or mm-hmm. I love this genre of music, or I only watch this, or I only listen to this. And I think attention span almost might have something to do with it as well. Mm. Overall, I just feel like this period of film really kind of took a hit as far as like being remembered by modern audiences.
Mm-hmm.
Like this sort of period of, well, it's not into like the 70s blockbusters yet,
right?
But we're moving out of like the black and white era. We're moving out of that sort of era of movies. This is kind of like that little in between period, which I think is honestly one of my favorite periods in film history.
There you go.
But in general, I think it's one of the ones that, like, when people think of people, especially people that aren't huge movie buffs,
mm-hmm.
think of, like, eras of film history. You have silent movies, you have early, like, kind of sound movies, black and white movies. Then you move into an era where there was, like, a lot of war movies and a lot of musicals.
Yep.
And then there's this kind of weird period, mid-60s to, like, early 70s, before you get into the blockbusters, before, like pre-Jaws, I would say.
Mm-hmm. You're getting your Doris Day movies and
yeah.
things like that. Yep.
Yeah, you're kind of getting this stuff, like a lot of the late Westerns, you're kind of getting, mm-hmm. so like the spaghetti Westerns.
Yep.
You're getting these kind of movies. You're getting, again, some of my favorite movies, just Godfather and the Sting, French Connection, some of that stuff, like
yep.
some really kind of like powerful character dramas
mm-hmm.
that don't really fall into any of those easily defined eras. And I think that period in general, and if you're not one of like, if you're not the Godfather, or you're not like one of those like top three movies from that era, you're not going to get remembered.
Yeah. Which is sad because that's why I do this podcast.
Yeah.
So Faye Dunaway, I mean, mm-hmm. she felt like the perfect Bonnie for that era.
Oh, 100%.
Now, what about Warren Beatty? Do you think, I mean, obviously they needed Warren Beatty to even get this film made, but uh-huh. as just an actor, pure actor, do you think he was the right actor for Clyde?
I think it works.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we don't really have anything to compare it to.
Right.
If it would be a character that had been done more like, let's say if someone else did a version of this thing, if someone else had made a movie based on the Bonnie and Clyde kind of mythos, he might not stack up as well. But like, just for having this movie, I think he works.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's of the main cast, he's probably one of the least memorable, not the worst. We'll get to the worst.
Okay.
I think he fades into the background a little bit sometimes because you have, like you said, you have Faye Dunaway who's just absolutely eating it up.
Yep.
You have Gene Hackman who's very, very, very good in that role of,
yep.
of the brother who kind of gets drawn into it. But then when he's in, he's in.
Yep.
You have the memorable cameo from Gene Wilder. You have Denver Pyle playing the detective that's kind of following them, and
yep.
of course anyone who's a fan of television from that area will of course know him as why is the name eluding me right now?
He's in
the Andy Griffith Show. He is Briscoe Darling in the Andy Griffith Show.
Yep, and then he's Uncle Jesse, and
then he's Uncle Jesse in the Dukes of Hazzard later. Yep. So he's very famous for television, but I think he does a really good job in this role. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, you have Michael J. Pollard as C.W. Moss as kind of like the audience surrogate a little bit.
Yeah, the composite, yeah.
The composite of a couple different people in real life that kind of is the audience's inroad to this story. You see him evolve. You see him being drawn into this sort of dark web of characters and being sort of have his character perverted by it. You see at the end, you see when they return to his family and you basically see his dad's reaction to like, what happened to you pretty much.
Right.
And so it's just a great composite of characters.
Okay, so you haven't mentioned her, so I'm assuming you think Estelle Parsons is the worst?
By far.
Okay, and she won an Oscar, too.
And she's the only one that won an Oscar.
Which is crazy.
Which is absolutely crazy. Insane. I mean, I the one thing I didn't do is look into who won the Oscars that year, because I know they were all nominated for Oscars.
Yeah, everyone, pretty much. All the actors.
It's interesting that she was the one that won it. I find her performance really one note. Okay, so looking up real quickly. Oh, that makes sense. the year that the Oscars technically made a huge boo-boo, that was the year that Rod Steiger won for In the Heat of the Night.
Right.
And he shouldn't have even won for that movie, because Sidney Poitier definitely should have won for that
100%.
Movie. 100%. Yeah. So it definitely makes sense that Warren Beatty didn't win. Katharine Hepburn won for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yep.
Which, yeah, I can see that, but I think I would probably go to Gone with Faye Dunaway for that. And then George Kennedy won for Cool Hand Luke.
I can't dispute that one.
So, yeah, no. I definitely think that it's just kind of hilarious that of all of them that Estelle Parsons was the one that won for this movie, when I think definitely her performance is the worst of all of the main characters, and it's very one note, and it's kind of early damsel in distress scream queen kind of thing. If I heard her screaming one more time.
Well, it's almost like they had to give something to Bonnie and Clyde because they nominated everyone. But I would argue of the five nominated, I would have probably given it to Catherine Ross for The Graduate.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a stacked year as far as Academy Awards go, which is, again, just such a shame that this period has kind of fallen. I mean, the movies that I see just for Best Picture and Best Director are In the Heat of the Night, Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, In Cold Blood, Dr. Doolittle, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Cool Hand Luke was that year. But yeah, so it's definitely it's a stacked year as far as top-notch films go. So of all of them, I definitely think it's kind of funny that Estelle Parsons was the only one to come out of this with an award.
Right. So, you know, we kind of touch upon this. So for many analysts of this film, it's somewhat noticeable that Clyde's impotence was essentially code for him being either homosexual or at the least bisexual. What's your take on this theory?
Yeah, it definitely, for a film that's this forward about a lot of things, it wouldn't surprise me if that was what it would be coded for. Mm-hmm. I've never done enough research in real life to know if it was based on any kind of real life kind of story about Clyde Barrow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where I land on that one. It wouldn't surprise me just with like I mentioned the film's rather blunt sexuality.
Well, it's even back in 1967 they couldn't come out, I think, and have the main character be gay, at least for an A-list film. So I think this was the way to potentially touch upon the subject, but actually without actually coming out and saying it. No pun intended.
Yeah.
All right. What are some of your favorite scenes in the film?
I think the action scenes were all done extremely well. I think they were blocked very well. I think they were shot very well. I think in general, the cinematography is phenomenal in this film. The final scene, of course, has to be probably my favorite. Just it comes almost out of nowhere. It's very effective in that way, where it's not kind of like we talked about. It's not glorified. It's just it happens. They all kind of look at the bodies and that's the movie.
Yeah,
and I think it's especially when you see the look on Denver Pyle's character's face, just kind of like, is this what the world is coming to? Like, like people, like this generation, kind of like you said, anti-authoritarian, rebelliousness a little bit. And I think it's almost a little bit of a comment. I mean, the movie is 1967. It might be a little bit of a comment on that era as well.
Sure,
Vietnam, and that sort of the restlessness and rebelliousness of that era, the counterculture movements,
civil rights,
rights, the counterculture movements, Vietnam, that whole thing. But I think that the ending is handled very well, and I think it definitely sticks out. Whereas a lot of the rest of the action scenes in the rest of the movie are very like classic, larger than life gunfight. I mean. Yep. Running out with using a mattress as a shield and like windows blown up and cops falling through doors and stuff like that. And it's very larger than life. But when it comes to the ending, it's very subdued. And I'm trying to think what right word would be, almost like dirty. Like, and it's like, okay, well, that's it. That's the end. And I think that's why that's probably my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah. It's almost like today you're almost expecting like, you think of like True Romance or something like that, you know, where he magically, he's not really dead, you know, not to give anything away, but that doesn't happen in this one. This is like, you know, it's over. And I kind of like that they don't belabor it. You know, it's just like it happens, it's done. And you just saw the story of Bonnie and Clyde. So,
yeah.
So what are your final thoughts on the film?
Oh, yeah, no, I think it's definitely for anyone who hasn't seen this movie, I think it's a great time capsule for this era of cinema. Very cutting edge, like you said. It pushes the boundaries a lot. It's a great reflection on the Great Depression, but also a reflection on the time period that it was made. And it's really interesting to see a lot of these actors and actresses early in their career, like you mentioned, Faye Dunaway, Gene Hackman, Gene Wilder, all in very early roles, some of them different from what they would later come to be famous for. But it's a very well acted film. The ensemble is really, really great, apart from the one exception that I mentioned. But I think it's a very well acted movie. It's a very well filmed movie, a very well directed movie. And I think that a lot of that credit does have to go to Warren Beatty. Like you mentioned, the film would never be made without him. He was the impetus for the film being made. But yeah, no, I think it's a great movie. I think it's definitely for anyone who's interested in that time period. I think it's a great time capsule for that, but also, like I mentioned, a great time capsule for when it was made and the issues that were going on at that time as well.
Well, you heard it from the younger generation, folks. You need to go out and see this film. And this era is one of Joseph's favorites. So again, thank you as always for doing this, Joseph.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoy this podcast and are an iTunes user, please do the show a favor and head on over to the official iTunes page for Damn Good Movie Memories. Be sure to leave a rating and a review. This will allow the show to appear higher in the algorithm and spread the joy of this podcast to the masses. If you are not an iTunes user, you can still listen and subscribe on Podbean at damngoodmoviememories.podbean.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook under our Damn Good Movie Memories page. You can also listen to a limited number of episodes on YouTube. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and be sure to tune in next week for an all-new episode of Damn Good Movie Memories.